podcast this week, we get a tune out of Leah Woodall, the star of Tuner. Plus the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that is currently wearing a Skeletor mask. It's what He-Man would have wanted.
You cannot defeat me, He-Man!
Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Emperor Podcast. This week, I'm joined by three colleagues of such lethal cunning. Geek Queen Helen O'Hara is here.
Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I am very well. I had a sunny weekend by the sea.
Did you?
That's nice. Yeah, okay. I went to glamorous Hastings.
Ah, the Caspian Sea.
Yes, famously.
Yes, indeed. The nicest serial killer in the business is here, Ben Travis.
Hello.
How are you?
I am well.
Yes. Are you melting in this heat or are you okay?
It's relatively air-conned in this studio.
Relatively. Yes,
it was very stuffy when we got in.
Yes, very much so. It's the heat has stripped the skin off my face, as you can see. And of course, last but not least, we are joined by the mad titan of movies. James, you also have a Skeletor mask? This is so weird. Oh no, wait, that's your actual face.
That's just my big bald head.
Yeah. James, can I say, there was one time, this was maybe like a year or two ago, that I think you'd been off sick for a while, like a week or a week and a half or something. I think it was maybe the bad food poisoning incident.
That was
something.
COVID. If it was a week, it was COVID.
There was one time that you and I had a Teams call and I hadn't seen you in a while and you'd been off sick and I could like literally see your skull. I was like, it was terrifying.
I'd gone full Skeletor.
You'd gone
really?
Full Skeletor. I was really like, is James okay? I could see his whole skull.
I think that might have been when I caught COVID when I was away, because I know I didn't eat. Like, I felt dreadful and couldn't get off the 7. I barely ate and I lost tons of weight. So I probably did look quite Skeletor-esque.
Wow.
Probably not help, but I was bellowing, I'm going to get you, He-Man!
Yeah.
I mean, that's a normal Monday morning meeting for
that's
us.
Pretty much what
Empire
you do.
Online.
Yeah. That's accurate.
It's actually pronounced He-Man.
Definitely not pronounced He-Man.
That's very upsetting somehow. I can't justify why, it just is.
welcome all, welcome one, welcome all three of you. I hope that you are very well. I'm boiling in this heat, absolutely boiling. It has been the hottest May on record, or at least 2 days of it.
This year, it grows hot.
Don't do it, James.
The demon that makes trophies of men.
Yes, otherwise I will be the demon that makes a trophy of you. Do not do that. Listen, shall we have a question?
Yes.
Yay.
Yeah, enough of this cracking and hilarious small talk. Let's get into it with an amazing, amazing question, which comes to me via Instagram, and I haven't lost it, and I'm not trying desperately to buy time until I find it. But anyway, Helen, tell us more about the sea that you were beside. Was it a briny sea? Was it a beautiful ocean? Tell me more.
I'm not sure we call the English Channel a beautiful ocean.
45 seconds to a minute.
I was hanging out with my small niece and nephew, which was extremely good fun. I learned all about the cool books that are hot with the under 8 set at the moment.
Yes.
You know?
Such as? Yes. Tell us more.
Obviously, like, Dog Man remains supreme, surprising no one, right? I mean,
so
we all
dog,
knew that.
So man.
Are they
so
Captain dog. Underpants pilled?
Yes, absolutely. But also, The Boy Who Grew Dragons, something called Donut Squad.
Yes.
Bunny versus Monkey again remains very, very popular. And for smaller children, they recommended the Hobbit graphic novel. They're obviously moving on to the real thing.
And have they managed to avoid the epidemic of like the poop that pooped a butt?
No.
Oh, no, they still think those are pretty
hilarious. Brendan Cracknell, fan account, sent in this question on Instagram and asks, is it ever awkward going on a film set?
Well, I mean, if you're not invited, yes. Deeply, deeply awkward as they remove you bodily from the set. Or in my case, you just pretend to be a runner and blend right in. I was the Marcus Brody.
You blend right in.
Yeah,
yes,
I blend right
in. Any luck, you've got the grail already.
Exactly that. I was the Marcus Brody of film set invaders when I invaded Pearl Harbor and I pretended to be a runner and I took pictures on the set and put them up on the internet and got in trouble.
What part of Pearl Harbor shot in the UK? That's the bit I'm
You know when, like, Rafe's on secondment with the RAF.
Oh,
there's a whole sequence. They shot it. I can't remember. I want to say it was in the West Country somewhere. It wasn't too far away. It was a couple of hours drive away from my house. And I drove down there and they had actual Spitfires taking off and landing, which was cool.
Cool.
But yes, I wandered onto
Duxford.
You could do, yes. And I ran into Ben Affleck and I wandered around the set. And if anyone spoke to me, I asked if they wanted a cup of tea. And they went, oh, yeah, please. And I went and got them a cup of tea. And so
Where did you get this cup of tea?
The craft services table.
So had you scoped it out or were you finding the craft services as you went?
I was very young and without any shame at all, so I just winged it. But that was quite an awkward way to be on a film set.
You could have improved the film immeasurably. If you'd made your way to Michael Bay, you could have made some script suggestions.
I think he would have murdered me if I'd even offered him to.
I think he would have admired your chutzpah.
You think?
And your cojones. I think he would have...
Really?
Yes.
That sounds a lot like the demon that makes trophies of men. El Cazador Trofeo de los Hombres.
Yes, yes. Thank you, James. That's the only time I've actually understood it when you said that. I think he would have admired you. He would have gone, hey, kid, you got moxie. Yeah. You got moxie. You got chutzpah.
Yes.
And you have cojones.
Yes.
And those three things, that's a deadly combination.
Well, they'll get him far in life. They'll get him all the way here.
To the FBI podcast. I mean, every week you infiltrate... this podcast.
I do,
every week I change the studio, like the Black Castle in Krull, but it turns up at a different place. And nevertheless,
here I am.
Here you are.
You know why? Because I am inevitable.
You are.
Yeah, we need to get the glaive back off him. God, that film sucks.
That's
Krull.
What the fuck?
I have watched it more recently than either of you. I know whereof I speak.
Helen,
we've had this conversation.
Don't watch films that you have an emotional attachment to because you saw them as a kid. Have you not learned anything from the Goonies?
I don't
Goonies?
Have an emotional attachment to it. You guys do. I'm fine.
Oh, so you came in wanting to hate it?
No.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
I saw it as a kid, and even then, I was pretty sure it was shit.
And yet you gave West Side Story 5 stars. What's up with that?
West Side Story is a banger.
Great movie.
Get out of here.
Oh, Krull is a
don't
banger.
Don't you fucking start.
Hello. Krull is an absolute banger.
Yeah.
And I wish I'd been on set of that and made it awkward.
Banger in the sense of like an old broken down car? Yes.
It has Liam Neeson in it. And yes. Robbie Coltrane. Yes.
Are you telling me that Liam Neeson has never made a bad movie.
This is absolutely true. Has never done a bad film. Ever.
Never done.
Never.
And
never
I happened. Challenge you not to go to the IMDb and look that up. Have you ever made it awkward on the set of a Liam Neeson movie? Have you ever been on set of a Liam Neeson movie?
There's no room.
Nick has. He was telling me yesterday he was on set of Liam Neeson in Unknown and watched a scene in which Liam Neeson checked into a hotel for 2 straight hours.
Was it like that scene in Taken 3 and they shot it from like 17 angles to intercut?
Yeah.
Him checking into this hotel.
I'm definitely from America. definitely from America, so I am.
So is.
Wee buns, as they say in New York. I have cojones and chutzpah.
I mean,
not to mention moxie.
I think my most awkward moment on a film set is when I talked to a particular film's dialogue coach and she thought I was Scottish.
Oh my God.
You're not Scottish?
Was she worse than the Scottish screen?
Yeah.
Which film?
I don't know if I should say.
Of course you can fucking say.
I don't know.
Do not ruin the story.
I'm not like getting an A-lister in trouble. I'm getting the dialogue
What does it
coach.
Rhyme
How
with?
How do you get the dialogue coach in trouble? It's your accent that's at fault here.
How is it my accent at fault?
Because she thought you were Scottish.
Yeah.
In her defense, you do have a strangely nebulous, hard to pin down accent.
No, Nebula has a Scottish accent.
She does actually, yeah.
Although not in the films where it's American. What was the film? You can't do this. You can't say I was instead of a film, but redacted.
Yeah.
You have to give us the scoop.
Oh,
Helen.
I tell you what, it could be one of two films and I don't remember which one it was because I was on two in a row.
Wow.
Huntsman, Snow White and the Huntsman, and then Huntsman Winter's War.
I can't believe you named them. That's an outrage. But I have to say, our stories are not rock and roll.
No.
It's not like, I went on set of Paddington in Peru and I was doing lines of coke with Paddington. Our story's not like that.
Well, no, surely it would be more awkward if Paddington was doing lines of coke and
but
we're
off
left
my arse.
Out.
Yeah. I felt left out. But our story...
Because also, it was prime Peruvian stuff.
Oh.
Our stories are, we went on set and someone thought I was Scottish. That's our stories. That's all we have. Ben, have you ever been awkward on a film set? Have you ever like gone onto film set and your trousers have fallen down?
Slipped on a banana peel. All the lights came down.
Yeah, and then you know, slid in through into the shot to tackle out. Which is what happened to me, of course, on Avengers Infinity War. But anyway.
I don't think I've had any really awkward ones. I had a really underwhelming one, which was a season of Luther.
Luther!
The one that Wumi Musaku was in, whichever season that was. And it was like, go on set of Luther, find out, blah, 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 blah. And we basically watched Wumi Musaku look at a board of evidence and then leave the room for like 2 hours. And they were like, eventually Idris Elba will be here. You will see Idris Elba. We're going to get some Idris Elba stuff. And we waited and waited and waited while they reshot this just very basic moment from several angles. And then Idris Elba turned up and immediately they were like, right, you guys have all got to go. That's it. That was the end of the day.
Wow.
I don't think I ever wrote anything about it because nothing happened. So that was like, that was a very underwhelming one. I've never been awkward. There are awkward moments when you have group interviews, when it's like a press day on set. And, you know, we all hold our hands up. At times we may have asked stupid questions at times.
What do you mean?
But I will say sometimes in group interview situations, other people ask questions that you sit there and go,
what the fuck?
What in the world was that? Where did that come from? So I feel like those are the main awkward moments that come up on those roundtable interviews. People just asking weird shit.
That happened to me. I'm sure I've told this on the podcast before, but that happened to me on the set of Rennie Harlan's Mindhunters in Amsterdam in 2003, I want to say, because the film came out in 2004, 2005. No, it was 2001 I went and set because Liverpool were playing in the UEFA Cup that night. And I remember it very well. Anyway, and then the film took a while to come out because we got stuck in Weinstein land. But I went and set of that, and it was a roundtable situation. Most times when we go on sets, we have the set not to ourselves because there are people making the film there, but we go on alone, just as Empire. But sometimes you go on and there's a group of other people. And we were interviewing a bunch of people, Val Kilmer and LL Cool J and Johnny Lee Miller and people like that, and obviously Rennie Harlan as well. And then Clifton Collins Jr. came on. I don't know if you've ever seen this movie. It's a masterpiece. And Clifton Collins Jr. came in and we were getting on all right as a group with him. And then I thought, you know what? It's just something popped into my head. I'm gonna ask him. And I said, has it ever struck you as weird that there are lots of people with three names in the cast? And he went, what? And he went, LL Cool J, Johnny Lee Miller, Clifton Collins Jr. And I started to panic and I went, Val Kilmer.
Val Kilmer.
And he just looked at me like I was a piece of shit on the bottom of his shoe. And he just went, what? No, what? No. And then someone else stepped in and asked a proper question. And then we kept talking for another 10 minutes or so. And I was just slowly dying inside. And then he left. And the esteemed British film journalist, Martin Palmer, is a lovely, lovely, lovely guy. Waited until he left the room and then just came across me and went, Chris, mate, what the fuck was that? I was like, don't really know. Don't really, my soul left my body for a second.
I thought I had something for a split second.
I thought we were riffing. I thought we were like comedically entwined. He was going to get it. We were going to become best buds. It didn't happen. Didn't happen. But we should get to the kind of the nub of the question, which is that set visits can be quite awkward, right? So when you go on them, we're journalists, we're interlopers, we're people from the outside. Even if you are friendly with people on the movie, whether it's director or producer or writer or, you know, whatever, it can still be really, really awkward because you're not meant to be there. And finding a place to stand, finding a place to sit, knowing how to comport yourself, knowing how to interact. Do I speak to the director if I'm sitting beside them? Do I sit back and let them do their thing? Do I just try and shrink into the background if something happens in front of me that's kind of contentious? Do I, you know, hide? Do I run away?
It does depend, doesn't it? Because sometimes you feel like you're there. Obviously, you've been invited by the studio, by the sort of PR system to be there. But sometimes you get more of a sense that the filmmakers know you are there, or sometimes they are just, you know, they're in director land. They're very busy. And as you say, you kind of watch them and see what they do. You might get a quick hello, but they have a thousand things on their brain and they're not in the zone to be answering your questions or kind of going out of their way to make you feel
they're not, nice, you're not your babysitter.
No, exactly. So sometimes it is just, you do just feel like you're standing on the side, you know, trying to make some notes without looking like the journalist in the corner making notes about what's going on. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting feeling. I had one for the TV show A Gentleman in Moscow, which starred Ewan McGregor and also Mary Elizabeth Winstead, couple in real life. And it was like a big emotional scene for those two where she had to like leave him. And it was extremely emotional. And she was like in floods of tears in the scene, but also like after the takes and stuff. And I spoke to Ewan McGregor afterwards because it was a very emotional day, a very emotional set, which is great for the story. It's great for the piece. But I was like trying to watch what's going on whilst also not be in anybody's eye lines. Like, ignore that I'm here. I don't want to be prying in this moment, even though it's my job to pry while you cry.
Wow. What a motto for us all.
I pry, you cry. That's my motto. Yeah.
I went on set of a film called Easy Virtue with Jessica Biel and Ben Barnes and Colin Firth and
Oscar
Kristen Scott
Wilde
Thomas.
Adaptation or Noel Coward?
And they told me to get there for some ungodly hour of the morning. And then I didn't talk to anyone at all until well after 2 o'clock. So I'd literally been sitting there for 5 hours. And at one point, we were sitting directly behind Kristen Scott Thomas, who had come over to, you know, we were sitting in the video village where the director and heads of department and so on will hang out. And she came down and sat right in front of us. And I was sort of gesturing to the unit publicist who kind of escorts you around on a lot of these visits, like, Maybe now would be a good time. We could talk to Kristen. And she was absolutely not trying that at all.
She probably couldn't understand your thick Scottish brogue.
It's probably that. But also, like, I think, I get it. Like, she was not willing to in any way ask if I could talk to her. So I was literally sitting next to her for 2 hours, but not allowed to talk to her. And I wasn't sure. I felt like a bad journalist because I'm like, should I be actively like leaning forward and tapping her on the shoulder and interrupting? But again, she is a bit scary and I didn't want to. And then I finally got to sit down with Ben Barnes and Jessica Biel in the sort of disused kind of National Trust cafe of this stately home that they were shooting at. And then 30 seconds after that, they got called back to set. And that was my only interview of the day.
Wow.
Not a good set visit. Not a good set visit.
So at that point, you want to start ruining takes as a sort of tit-for-tat retaliation.
Is that what I want? I mean, I didn't really.
Yeah. Or improving takes. As anyone who's seen Easy Virtue would know. Come on now. Come on. Let's all play nice. Anyway, should we take a little break?
Let's.
Should we make it awkward?
Always.
Whatever, if you want to, it's fine.
How do you want to make it awkward?
Honestly, Chris, it's up to you. I don't care.
Well, yeah.
Just do what you need to do and we'll just go with it.
Yeah, what the fuck does that mean?
Well, just like, I don't know.
I don't think that was that difficult to figure out.
It's sort of obvious, right?
Have I upset you in some way? I mean, maybe we should talk about this in the break. Listen, we're going to take a little break now and yeah, we'll be back in a second.
Guess.
Bye. Okay, we are back, everybody. Ben and I have made it less awkward. We have patched up whatever differences Ben thought we had, which is very typical of Ben to act like that, by the way.
This feels like very blamey language. You're going to reopen the rift right now.
And now it is time to delve deep into this week's movie news. I think we've just done it. There isn't actually that much movie news, is there? But what would you like to talk about? We are recording this on Wednesday afternoon, should say. So that is Hollywood's signal now to drop some earth-shattering news that would warrant talking about. But what would you like to talk about?
Can we talk about how they're trying to avoid an omni-shambles on Paddington 4? Having obviously at the end of Paddington 2 said fuckity bye to Paul King and that kind of creative team. Dougal Wilson did Paddington in Peru.
You let Dougal do a Paddington?
I thought he did an okay job.
I
like the Father Ted reference.
Yeah, it was a good reference.
Good one. Okay. So yeah, we have writers for Paddington 4, none other than Armando Iannucci and his regular collaborator Simon Blackwell.
Yes.
Of The Thick of It and Veep and Death of Stalin fame is taking on Paddington. It just tickles me immensely that Armando Iannucci, who is behind some of the most gloriously vicious lines ever spoken on television, is going to get to put words in Paddington's mouth.
But he also did David Copperfield, right?
Yes.
Not The Magician, the Dickens story.
The personal history of David Copperfield.
Which was much, you know, cuter than, than say, you know.
He wasn't dropping F-bombs.
No, there weren't nearly so many F-bombs.
No,
I have always thought that's largely the problem with it.
Yeah, Dickens, but no dicks.
There you go. So you know, I'm super excited. I agree. This is a really, really good call. It's it feels interesting without being like wildly silly.
And you need it to be funny, right? Like, very there was much. Still some good humor in Paddington in Peru, but it was that very specific blend on the first two of, yes, it's wholesome and it's beautifully crafted, but they're funny movies, they're comedies. And so to have some good kind of comedy blood writing this one is a good sign. There are talks for Dougal Wilson to return as director, which I think we can all agree Paddington in Peru was not outstanding, which is a bit of a shame because Paddington 2 was outstanding. But
and Paddington. Both five-star films.
But, you know, I thought it was solidly directed, Paddington in Peru, and he gets a sense of, like, the visual whimsy and the world. And so having done one of them, I would not be against him coming back for a second.
I think he has exactly the energy you want from a Paddington director. You know, he's a slightly shambolic, steaming, but extremely warm and actually very clever and creative guy. So I agree that there were things that could have been better in Paddington in Peru, but I don't feel like the direction was the big, big issue there. So I think it was
a screenplay. And Paddington's ego, frankly, is
he's a monster.
The stories I've heard from
he also had to keep leaving the set to like escort people to the afterlife, and it just really cut into his filming time, you know. So hopefully this time he can really focus on the actual movie.
Commit to the movie, Paddington.
Sorry, I've got to walk the Queen into the pearly gates. My time has come. Why has he become like the British Grim Reaper?
The harbinger of doom.
The psychopomp.
It's very much the psychopomp.
We're a deeply weird nation. And I feel like Paddington should be explored in the third 28 years later.
When like an autopsy type thing.
I mean, if Paddington gets the rage virus, who knows what happens?
Oh, God.
God, hard stares all around. Dougal Wilson's really interesting because I feel like maybe if he's doing this one, he will feel a little freer as a director to not do a Paul King impression, which I think was, he felt maybe a little straitjacketed by that. There's a lot of flourishes in Paddington in Peru that feel like they went, what would Paul King do at this point? He would have a whimsical animated sequence. Let's do that, shall we? And if Dougal Wilson can maybe bring a little bit more of himself to it, then we could be marmaladen with quality, I think, going forward. Because there's, you know, these guys are two of the best screenwriters around.
Absolutely.
And Armando is knocking it out of the park at the moment on Taskmaster.
He is wonderful on Taskmaster. This is the other thing. Obviously, he writes incredibly, hilariously acerbic dialogue, but he is such like a happy dude on Taskmaster. He's just a lovely, sweet guy, and he seems to be having a lot of fun.
Yeah, very much so. So looking forward to that. Okay.
Hooray, yeah.
Somehow we've done 28 minutes on Paddington 4.
Yeah. Another thing that I think is good news, I think, is that Radio Silence, aka Matt Bettinelli-Olpin and Tyler Gillette.
The best can get.
Yes.
Give me 5 seconds.
Are making a choose-your-own-adventure film. How will this work?
To hear the rest of the story, turn to page 253.
Yes.
Did you ever keep your finger on the previous page?
Yes, obviously. Yes.
And did anyone ever actually roll dice for the combat, or did you just win?
Sorry, our younger listeners may not know what we're talking about. So there used to be things called books.
Made of paper.
And you used to read them, and sometimes you could keep your finger in a previous page. just in case you didn't like what happened.
These were traditionally the Steve Jackson, Ian Livingston books, and you'd have choices.
No, I meant all the
different pages. Ben, this was before the advent of video games.
This sounds like an analog Bandersnatch.
I mean, in many ways, it was that.
It was so. It was basically like, you know, if you want to go into the dark mine, turn to page 84. If you'd like to continue up the hill, turn to page 57.
Right,
and you were meant to play with dice, and you were meant to roll it.
But
write
no one
down
did.
Your,
no, no, but because we were all risk averse, we would put every finger we had in different pages to keep all of our options open.
So we could go back if
we died, and you could die quite easily.
Yeah. I read things like these when I was a youngster.
What books?
Books, yes. I liked the pages and how they turned and the words and stuff. No, I'm pretty sure I read some Goosebumps, like Choose Your Own Adventure books. They were still a thing in the early 90s.
Okay, that's good. Okay.
Fair enough. You can still buy them.
These were things like The Warlock of Firetop Mountain.
Yes,
and
Death Trap Dungeon.
Death Trap, oh my God, the cover of Death Trap Dungeon is seared into my mind.
With the blob thing, with all the eyes.
Yeah. Oh, fantastic stuff.
Temple of Terror.
Yeah.
Citadel of Chaos.
Yes.
What are they going to do? Are they going to do a thing? Is it going to be like Clue, where if you go and see it in different screenings, different things happen?
This,
or is it going to be something where they build the Choose Your Own Adventure mechanism into the story and you have characters who are having to make choices and then maybe time rewinds because they didn't like the choice they made? Or
you did not go see Ready or Not 2 in sufficient numbers to make a sequel. Go back and see it again.
I feel like there's a couple of things like they could potentially do. So first of all, you know, we don't know yet. It could be on streaming or something. I guess it's being made for 20th Century Studios, but they haven't, I don't think the story talked about specifically cinema release, but we're assuming cinema release. They have done this kind of thing on streaming. Obviously, the Kimmy Schmidt movie with Daniel Radcliffe, for example, did exactly this.
Kimmy Schmidt movie?
Yeah. Oh, sort of it? Movie length. Yeah, after
was
the main season ended. Yeah,
I didn't know
Daniel
that.
Radcliffe's in it. It's really cute.
Oh, it's a very different Unbreakable.
Is it gone?
That and Bandersnatch have been wiped from existence. So Netflix let go of that technology that they created to do the Choose Your Own Adventure.
You can't keep your fingers in Netflix.
No, you can't. No.
You could
try it.
There must be something you could probably do with like your phones in a cinema. Like if you put a QR code on the screen at the beginning of each screening, you know, that you could.
Yeah. But do you want people taking their phones out in a screening, maybe? I don't know.
I don't know, but I'm just saying there might be some way of doing that. If you've got digital projection, it might be possible.
This could be a great set visit to be awkward on.
Yeah, really good.
Bagsy. But of course, they're doing The Mummy next.
That is true, and I'm so excited.
So they were not going to get around to this for a long, long time. Unless, of course, they turn to page 73, in which case they can do both at the same time.
Maybe it's the same movie, and instead of the Book of the Dead, they find the Choose Your Own Book of the Dead.
Oh my God. That would be... You choose to retcon the mummy, the tomb of the dragon emperor, out of existence.
Great choice.
Never
great
choice.
Yes, that's it. You've completed the adventure. Oh, dearie me. That's exciting. Well done, Helen. Where did you read that?
On Empire?
Surely not. Are you sure? A word of it.
Refresh the page. It might disappear. That's exciting.
It's a few days old, admittedly.
Oh, okay.
The Batman 2 has finally gone into production.
I don't believe you.
No, it says it's actually underway. Like, production has begun here in the UK. The Batman 2 is the happening. It is.
Not too late to change that, Matt Reeves.
The event that is actually underway and not just being talked about for years.
Right.
How long has it been specifically since the
84
Batman?
84
years. I mean, almost.
It's not that long. I'm going to say 2022.
Sure. What are we saying? Anyone? Does anyone have access to any kind of internet that could tell us?
It came out in 2022, and so it'll be out next year. But it's a 5-year gap.
That's a big gap. We have had the Penguin in the meantime, to be fair. Yep. So we've had something to tide us over. But
did they pick up the Penguin for season two?
They did not pick up the Penguin, no. Sorry. But to be fair, I think it was more of a closed book than anything else.
And there's more of Colin Farrell going, fucking not doing that again. Jesus. Is he in this one? Is he in this movie, the Colin Farrell?
Who can say?
Oscar.
Not me.
Yeah, you're gorgeous. But who isn't it? It's very gorgeous people.
Oh, always.
So gorgeous.
Well, our fjord man himself, Sebastian Stan, is in this
rumored
one.
Rumoured to be Harvey Dent, but we don't have official confirmation on that. Scarlett Johansson.
Lunch and dinner.
Scarlett Johansson, Zoe Kravitz.
Zoe Kravitz is back.
Well, that's been rumored, actually. I don't know.
Who's confirmed it? Because Matt Reeves was actually like putting little clips of people on his Instagram and Twitter, wasn't he? a couple of weeks ago.
That's
true. I started filming this week in Liverpool, apparently.
Yes, yeah. There are Gotham police cars have been spotted in Liverpool outside St. George's Hall.
Very
going through the Queensway Tunnel.
Yes.
Which they shot at St. George's Hall on the first one as well. The
City Hall.
Okay. I'm glad they're back in they're keeping a consistent Gotham for this one, because we love the Nolan movies, but he moved around a bit, didn't he? He went very Chicago on The Dark Knight.
He went very Chicago on The Dark Knight, and then I think was worried it would be too Chicago, so then the third one is much less Chicago.
There's it's Pittsburgh, isn't it, the third one?
A lot of it's Pittsburgh, but not all of it. I think there's New Jersey and stuff in there as well.
New Jersey.
And of course, Wall Street.
Bit of Nottingham. Woollerton Hall was Wayne Manor.
Glasgow
tends
as well.
To shoot near me. I don't know why this is. I just attract
Batman the
bat. Productions.
Oh my God. In addition to being a nice psychopath, are you also a Batman villain?
All right. Well, that's exciting. I look forward to talking about that next year.
Hurrah.
Yeah, it's 5 years. That's not too long. That is not too long.
I'm going to do a James Pearl Harbor situation and just turn up and try to take some photos.
You should. Yeah. You absolutely should.
Hand out tea.
You have a Paul Dano energy to you. They might think that you're a Paul Dano.
Tarantino would agree.
Oh.
Well, everybody who came out against Tarantino is on my side.
Yeah, that stands to reason.
I think you could get on the set.
Weak sauce.
Yeah.
Just try and be
just
Paul
say,
Dano.
Just hello, I am Paul Dano. Give it a go.
I am here. I am the Riddler.
Yes. I'm here to riddle.
Riddle me this. Should I be here? Should I not?
Yeah. Is Shifty Barry in it?
Well, he's listed on the IMDb, but I don't know that I trust it.
Okay. Well, he is Shifty by nature.
Well, indeed, yes.
Yeah. Shifty Joker.
Look,
love
I think
that
we'll
see.
The more interesting thing to me is Andy Serkis like flying in for like a week and doing all of his scenes and then flying back to
New
Zealand?
That's a very good point.
How does that work?
When's he start shooting on The Hunt for Gollum?
I thought it was like now already.
Interesting. So.
And all of his videos recently talking about The Hunt for Gollum, he's got a big man bun. So is Alfred going to have a man bun in Batman Part 2?
That would be hilarious.
He's a cool Alfred. It's exciting. That's exciting indeed. Anything else you want to talk about?
Should we talk about the Mandalorian and Grogu box office?
We should. We shall.
Okay.
Let's do it.
Well, let's do that then.
Because we talked about this last week, didn't we?
Yeah. We did.
We were predicting our top three movies of the year. And we said the Mandalorian and Grogu wasn't tracking at a hugely impressive rate, shall we say.
For a Star Wars movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's kind of proved to be the case. It's opened pretty well.
Yeah, rallied from the projected number, didn't it? It did better than expected.
Like by about 20 pence, yes. So it hasn't done... It made 100... It was a Memorial Day weekend, I think, in America, right? Memorial Day. Mm-hmm. And so it was a four-day weekend, and it made $100 million roughly in this four-day weekend, but under 200 million around the world. So we predicted last week it was going to tail off around 400 million. That seems pretty much on the money right now. It may even be less than that. And it's interesting to see how this is being spun in the media, because this is roughly the same amount of money that Solo made when it came out. And that was deemed to be such a catastrophe that they basically put everything on hold in Star Wars on the big screen, apart from the Skywalker saga.
Yeah.
This movie seems to be spun a bit more positively. It's the first Star Wars in 7 years on the big screen. 9 if you're the three of us in this room.
Good movie.
Say it. Yes!
There it is.
It's like that Simpsons thing. Say it.
Say the line. Undo it.
But it does seem to be spun a little bit more positively. Even though it is not going to be, by any measure, one of the biggest films of the year. Ben, what's your take on this, as someone who wasn't here last week?
I mean, there's various angles on it, aren't there? Because part of the positive spin is, if you're comparing it to Solo, it cost a whole lot less than Solo. Mm. Solo was a big, big, expensive movie, plus they did a lot of reshoots. So there were talks of that production cost overall on that film being like eye-watering, absolutely eye-watering. Whereas Mandalorian and Grogu is skewing bigger than the series, but I think people have said the budget is roughly $160 million, which is cheap for a Star Wars movie. And so obviously you have a lot of marketing costs and all the other things associated with it that also have to be accounted for, but like pure budget of the film itself has already been made back. And so I think there are talks that that in itself is being seen as a bit of a win. It's low in terms of box office for a Star Wars movie, but as a big screen adaptation of a streaming series in any other context, this is like gigantic box office. So it'd be really interesting to see how it plays out over the next few weeks. Obviously, that first weekend, you're going to get a lot of the core Star Wars fans. But it, the film itself skews quite nicely towards a family audience. It is the start of the summer. It'll be interesting to see if you get a lot of kind of continuous legs from families turning up, people taking their kids to go and see the Baby Yoda movie. As we head into, obviously it's half term this week as well, so it'll be interesting to see how the numbers go. But it is a strange
one,
isn't it?
It's done pretty well here.
Right. It's number one at the UK box office. And yeah, low for a Star Wars movie, big for a Mando movie and a Disney Plus spin-off movie.
But we don't know. We don't have nothing to compare it to.
Right. This is kind of unprecedented in terms of taking a show like that and putting it on the big screen.
I don't know whether it has justified it. What was their faith? Their faith in bringing Mando to the big screen. They must have thought, well, this is going to be gangbusters because people love The Mandalorian. So maybe this is a $600-700 million movie. I don't know. Are they going to be disappointed if this clocks in at 350, 400?
You would think so, wouldn't you? They're not going to be over the moon about it. They've got to have expected or very much hoped that it would have done better than that. But equally, as you say, this is kind of uncharted territory. There was no real way to know. Would people pay the premium for going to a cinema to see what is essentially three episodes of The Mandalorian taped together? So, I don't know. We talked about this. I know Ben and I spent like an hour discussing it on this podcast. We had a nice chat. It's very civil. No blows were exchanged. But ultimately, you know, we are still in a place where we are 7 or 9 years away from the last Star Wars movie. And this, rightly or wrongly, had a lot of expectation attached to it. And certainly for me, it did not feel like an event. It didn't scratch the itch. And it feels like, looking at the box office, that was true for a number of people.
It's interesting looking at the predictions nowadays for the box office. For a long time, the feeling was you would make 3 to 5 times your opening weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels the multiplier has really gone down. And I think that's a bit of a worry. That's a more general point about box office. That's not just Mando. But front-loading box office to that extent to the opening weekend, I know it traditionally helps studios because they get a bigger slice of the opening weekend and then it declines the longer that film is out. But it's roughly 50-50 between studio and distributor. But it feels like that is signaling that the cinema going public has really not quite recovered still, and we're still in this slight doldrums for the cinema going experience. And I feel like Mando's a really good, pretty good test case of that.
I don't know. I think there's lots of proof that people are willing to go back in droves for the right movie. I just don't think The Mandalorian and Grogu was the right movie.
Well, it's not what you would call in any way sort of experiential cinema, is it? Like, because it, by its very nature, it was birthed and raised on the small screen. So I don't think you're losing an awful lot, despite the many, many IMAX sequences.
But it eliminates a large percentage of the audience you might normally go see a Star Wars, because as much as it tries to be a standalone, you do need to be plugged into that show
to an extent. I think it's reasonably standalone.
One of the things about the film is that it is playing much more to a general audience than it is to a
Mando
Star Wars
fans.
Audience.
For better or worse.
Narratively, it's kind of weird in a way that it is shaping itself so you don't need to have seen any of the other stuff and kind of bringing you into those characters. I mean, with that head on as well, the other side of this that people are talking about is that the money they're going to be making from The Mandalorian and Grogu isn't just from the film itself.
Yeah.
And that the merch on this thing, the merch on Grogu, on Baby Yoda, has for years now been an absolutely massive money spinner for Disney. And I mean, one of the things that I'm just enjoying about Star Wars being back in cinemas is, especially at an age in my life where I'm like heading into toy shops regularly with a small child, all the toy shops are full of Star Wars toys, and it makes me so happy to see. But the sheer merch value in Grogu being out there on the sides of buses, on TV adverts, plastered everywhere, that hopefully will get kids going, I want to go and see that movie, but also is just going to get people going, oh, can I have a Baby Yoda plush? Everybody, buy yourself a Baby Yoda plush because they will make you happy. is another big sort of James, revenue money spinner from this film.
Will a Baby Yoda plush finally make you happy?
I mean, who knows? Either that or a mega Mandalorian Whopper meal or whatever it is that we had last week.
So. Oh, James, it was a galactic Mandalorian Whopper meal.
That's the one.
Did you have the Force fries?
No, we just had normal fries. I was hoping for the Force fries.
The Force fries have the same green goop that the burger had. You know, like the heartburn goop.
I'm very glad.
I don't think I want those on my fries.
We were spared that fate. Yeah. One last thing about this. It's interesting because you would look at the release schedule and go, oh, well, it doesn't really have a lot of competition in the same category, the same demographic, until next week with Masters of the Universe, which is also tracking to open fairly softly, and then a Toy Story 5 is coming up at some point. But what's interesting is I would think it's going to be knocked off the top spot this week by Backrooms, which we'll be discussing later on in the show. And this marks a bit of a renaissance in terms of horror. Horror, you know, has been, you know, obviously a big attraction on the big screen, but Weapons was huge, Sinners was huge, Backrooms is tracking to be A24's biggest opening to date with over $50 million. Obsession is becoming a phenomenon in the States in particular. Yes. It went up at the box office.
It went up by like 30% or something like that.
In its second weekend, which is virtually unheard of. And so The Mandalorian and Grogu might be about to face something even more terrifying than Rotta the Hutt. They might be about to face YouTuber the director, which is going to crush them like bugs. And Nate Bargatze also has a movie out this week. It'd be fascinating to see, because he's a big comedian in the States, and I'd be fascinated to see if that translates to a big boffle box office. But yeah, it's a fascinating time at the old box office. Mm. Keep an eye on that one. Anything else? No? Good? Should we move on?
Sure.
Should we have a guest?
Why not?
Should we have Leah Woodall?
Yes.
Sure.
Yeah, because Tuner actually opened last week in the States. It's opening wide this week. I think this movie's terrific. I would urge people, whether they're here or in the States, to go and see it, because it's exactly the sort of really interesting character-driven, I even hesitate to call it a thriller, but just character-driven drama that people don't go to see enough at the moment. And it could get lost in the back rooms. Mania and the obsession craze, the obsession with obsession, and of course The Mandalorian and Grogu. So do go and see it. It stars Leah Woodall, who of course was eye-catching in last year's Bridget Jones, Mad About the Boy. And Hollywood really is mad about the boy, aren't they, Helen? Because they've cast him in this and other things.
Other things. He's in something big coming up.
He's in Lord of the Rings, The Hunt for Gollum.
That's what I'm thinking.
Yes, and we talk about that very, very briefly. He seems to be very, very excited about doing that. He plays a character called Hallvard in The Hunt for Gollum. And there was, of course, a speculation he was going to play Aragorn or Strider in that movie, but that would be Jamie Dornan. We discussed that on the podcast, didn't we? We were like, is it going to be Leah Woodall? We're not so sure it is. And is he a good fit for that role? We decided ultimately he might not be a good fit for that role.
Okay.
But Andy Serkis thought he was a great fit for Hallvard, whoever that is. And he's also a great fit in Tuner, in which he plays a young man called Nicky, who is a piano tuner. He is kind of the apprentice, young apprentice, to Dustin Hoffman's wise old piano tuning hand. He has a medical condition. He has a hearing condition, which I believe is called hyperacusis, which means that he is essentially allergic to loud noises. He wears earplugs and he wears ear defenders when noise gets particularly egregious around him. But this also means that he has trained himself over the years to be an amazing piano tuner. And in this film, which is directed by Daniel Roher, he also discovers that this unique gift allows him to be able to crack safes. And I'm sure that works out nicely for everybody. So I went along and had a chat with Leo, who is a lovely guy, in a London hotel room a couple of weeks ago. And this is that chat. Do please enjoy. Leo, welcome to the Emperor Podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm great. Thank you.
This is a cracking film, Tuner.
Thank you.
I wasn't going to spoil too much about the heist elements of this movie, but it's on the poster, so I feel that we can talk about it.
Yeah, of course.
What did you know about it going in when you first got the screenplay? Or when you first heard about this movie? Did you know? Was that all that stuff a surprise to you?
I'm pretty sure. I was actually thinking about this yesterday. I don't know what I knew about the film before reading it. I just remember reading it and loving it and thinking this is a film that I want to watch. And it has so many different elements of what I kind of look for in a film and what I enjoy about film. And I think, you know, Daniel and Robert Ramsey, you know, did a really wonderful job of kind of integrating several different genres into this film.
Give me an insight into how, because the soundscape of this movie is fascinating, because Nicky has hearing difficulties in the movie, and the soundscape that Daniel plunges us into from time to time is really, really fascinating. How does that come across in the page? Was that something that leapt off the page for you?
Yeah, it was very well painted out in the script. You really get the idea of what it feels like. However, I didn't expect, you know, for it to be so effective. And I think Johnny Byrne did the most wonderful job.
When I saw the film.
I just think what he did with that sound design is so remarkable. And you really get inside of Nicky's head.
Mm.
And you can really, it's incredibly immersive.
Mm. How did you go about portraying that?
I think it was just kind of imagining what it would feel like to have, like, sounds kind of horrific, but like a needle go through your eardrum, or like, and like your sort of the inside of your head, like burning.
That's fascinating. So you're doing that on set whenever action's called, but you're thinking, okay, I've someone's just shoved a needle in my ear.
Yeah, it was just about, you know, really trying to capture the pain of it.
Mm.
You know, pain is a hard thing to to imagine in a way.
Yeah.
But a lot of it was also just kind of story driven, and there were it was also very important to make sure that the moment is captured, not just the pain of it, but how that, you know, like, for instance, the scene with Rufy when the fire alarm goes off, you know, what has led up to that point that makes this more effective, and you know, a lot of that also came down to Havana and her wonderful performance as well.
And what about someone like working with Dustin Hoffman on this film as well?
Who?
Yeah. I had to Google him. Did you? Because he is obviously one of the classic, I think maybe his methods changed over the years, but he was certainly a very, very method actor. I'm sure you've heard the famous story on Marathon Man where he was running around before a take and Laurence Olivier said, "Have you just tried acting, dear boy?" Did you ask him for advice in terms of conveying Nicky's condition and Nicky's what Nicky's going through?
Mm. It wasn't so much about asking him for advice, but just kind of watching him at work and watching how he operates and how he navigates his own performance and brings his own character to life. And, you know, he treats every take like a rehearsal, and he says so. And also when someone is that good, they make you better, and they bring you into the world of make-believe further than you may be able to bring yourself, you know.
It's the reason I wanted to ask about the screenplay and how it was written was that I think the first 20 minutes or so of this movie, before we even get an indication that Nicky has this other gift, are really, really important,
because you really, really like these characters from the off. You really like the dynamic that Nicky and Harry have. You begin to really sympathize and empathize with Nicky. And then the heist stuff begins to, you know, work its way in. Was that analogous to your experience in reading the screenplay? Like you went, okay, yeah, I get this character. I understand this character. I really like this character. And now he's making terrible decisions that might lead to a world of shit. And you begin to care for him. You're already on tenterhooks with this character.
Yeah. You need your character to have inner conflict and to make sort of bold choices. So I think when I was more just I kind of smirked when I realized that, you know, he got a little kick out of it.
Yeah.
And I understood it. I understood that he lives a very, very sheltered, kind of mundane life. And I understood that though it wasn't what he had planned for or what he'd ever dreamt of, you know, it was new and it was kind of dangerous and it was exciting. And it was he's been sort of longing to rebel against, you know, the kind of cards that he's been dealt. And so I kind of got it.
He's a guy who has an incredible gift, God-given gift, if you will, for music. He has this, you know, he's got perfect pitch. He's got this incredible ear, in a way. And then he discovers he has an aptitude for something else. He has a secondary gift, which is just as interesting in many ways. A little bit more dangerous, but interesting. Is that something you can relate to? Because, you know, as an actor, in the course of your work, have you discovered that second thing that you have an aptitude for?
No.
No special skills on the old CV.
Nah. I would love someday to try writing something.
Okay. All right.
I mean, when I was a kid, I used to do that, but to create something from scratch seems really kind of enticing to me.
So, I mean, you haven't written for a while, or
no?
What sort of stuff did you write as a kid?
Oh, we're talking like when I was a kid.
I
think I wrote a story about a dog. I was obsessed with dogs when I was a kid.
All right, tell me about the dog.
Dog doesn't die. I think that's okay. That's all.
Did the dog have a secondary gift?
Yeah, meowing.
Now we're getting somewhere, Leo. Yeah, a dog that can meow.
It's very.
This is a movie.
Yeah, it's very.
This is the 10-part Netflix series. We can make this work. So you haven't had any throwing yourself, learned any special skills then for movies over the years? So the things piano.
Yeah. That's one of the sort of. Well, I'll tell you what, I did a movie last year where I played a guy in the kitchen and I learned to shuck oysters. And I'm pretty darn good at that. the sort of head, the main man oyster shucker in Cape Cod was sort of teaching me the tricks of the trade. And he, might I say, he was pretty blown away by my ability to shuck.
How were you
at the
beginning? Were you shucking awful or?
Nicely done. I wouldn't say I was shucking awful, but I did get pretty cocky and I did like impale my hand because I would shuck it and then have a bucket and I would flick it, and as I was shucking, I'd sort of you get the top bit of the shell and then you get rid of it, but my game would be flicking them into the bucket. And then, of course, the camera turns around onto me and I decide to get extra cocky. I throw away the towel, the like protective towel, and I just decide to not even look at the oyster, and I was just looking at it and I just fully went into my hand.
Oh, Christ.
And it bled out.
Is there a scar or are you okay?
I kind of wish there was more of a scar, to be honest.
Oh, yeah, it'd be a real war story in that case.
Yeah, that'd be a bit more of a war story.
Look what I got doing Tony.
Yeah. Still, the knife is still through my hand.
Be like the scene from Jaws. This is Bridget Jones. Hurt my leg doing
when
that.
He's looking around trying to find a good scar.
Got this behind a year doing Tuner. Yeah.
What about this from the Indianapolis.
What about the piano playing that? I mean, I don't want to give away too much, but let's just say that, you know, you're around a lot of pianos in this movie.
I would like to be better. I would love to get to a level where, I mean, some of it, I mean, it's a really difficult instrument. Like, arpeggios are incredibly advanced. Yeah. I'd love to get to a level where, like, I can just nail some arpeggios. And at the moment, I'm just figuring out how I can really nail Interstellar and also The Shire.
Oh, yeah.
On the piano.
Yeah, that would be pretty cool.
So that's where I'm at.
So there's a moment in this movie where Dustin's character asks you to play something and you just kind of look at him enigmatically and then basically refuse. Mm. Is that you? If you were at a gathering, a soiree, and someone said, "Hey, Leo, you're in that movie Tuner. Give us a tune." You'd be like, "No, shuck off."
No, I'd go, "Shuck yeah." But if they asked me, if they asked me to play sort of, I don't know, Bach, then I'm a little screwed.
Yeah. So what are we doing? Okay, that's on a curve, graded on a curve. What would you play between Chopsticks and Bach? What's in between? What's your party piece?
It's going to be Interstellar.
I've
been chipping away at it.
All right.
And if there was a piano here, you'd get it. You know the song. You know the tune.
I know the tune. Yeah.
And I, Marius, our music's composer, sort of really helped me get into like the bass of it, and it sounds good.
That's amazing.
It's very intense.
You also mentioned The Shire there, and of course you are, I guess.
That wasn't me plugging that, by the way.
I know, but you've opened a door and I'm going to go through it.
Go through it, it's okay.
Because, of course, you've been announced in the cast for The Hunt for Gollum as Hallvard. Am I pronouncing that correctly, by the way? I am. Yeah. There we go. Nailed it.
I hope so. If you're not, I've confirmed it, then that's...
Have you said his name out loud yet?
Hallvard. It's one of each.
It's one of the two.
Yeah.
If not, you can fix it in post.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful thing. Yeah. Just get through the movie, mispronounce the name completely, and then just fix it in post. I imagine you're looking forward to that.
I cannot wait.
He knows his way around that world. Of course.
Oh yeah, I cannot wait. I love that world so much. I love that trilogy. Never thought I would get to sort of be part of that world. Especially not, you know, with Ian and Andy, like that, and I don't think I have any scenes with Elijah, but them being part of it is very special.
Amazing. And of course there was some speculation that you might be playing Aragorn, but you're not, you're playing Hallvard. But nevertheless, how's your door opening? Just in case there's a moment where you need to open a door in an extravagant manner. Are you okay?
I'm okay. Yeah. Right.
See? Add that to your special skills as well.
Yeah, okay, yeah, we'll add that. Door opening.
Door opening, shucking, playing piano to a reasonable level.
Yeah,
all right.
Sure,
yeah. Writing stories about dogs that can meow. Leo, you're a quadruple threat.
Yeah, very talented man.
Amazing. Well, best of luck on that movie as well.
Thank you for having me, pal.
Fantastic, cheers. Okay, that was Leo Woodall talking about Tuner, and should we kick off the review section with Tuner?
Hurrah!
You all right there, Alison?
Yeah, I was yawning and expressing enthusiasm at the same time.
Okay. Yeah, it's a great idea, Chris. Yeah, fantastic. Yeah. Really invested in this podcast. Jimbo.
Hello.
You've seen Tuner.
I have. It has nothing to do with fish.
Yeah.
Yes, this is, I mean, you already know what it is because you've already spoken to Leo Woodall, but it is about a piano tuner who uses his powers for evil. Or rather, for financial gain, at any rate. And to be fair, I would say to a good cause, right? So his mentor, Dustin Hoffman, who plays Harry Horowitz, his kind of like tuner-in-chief, if you will, he has mounting medical bills that they can't pay. So it turns out that our Nicky, who, as you say, has very acute hearing, realizes that he has a talent for cracking safes, not just tuning pianos, but also breaking into things. He meets a I think it's fairly safe, a fairly shonky security guy called Yuri, who while installing security systems, likes to rob his clients. And he puts Nikki's powers to use, cracking safes and essentially stealing things that won't be missed, or at least that is the theory. But running parallel to that thriller is also a love story. So Nikki meets Ruthie, played by Havana Rose Liu, and she's sort of a pianist. She's studying at a prestigious music school, and she's composing...
Juilliard, I think.
Juilliard, there we go. I've heard that's quite good, Helen.
Mm.
Yeah. And she's composing a piece, and their paths cross. I would say there's a little bit of friction at first. They don't get on, but obviously as meet cutes go, someone with perfect pitch, yay, not just on the keyboard, if you know what I'm saying, they get together, and there's a very sweet kind of love story.
I don't know what you're saying.
There's a very sweet love story kind of percolating in the background while all of this safe cracking is going on. So it's kind of what you said, Chris. Like, it's not really a thriller.
No.
It's kind of a drama. It's kind of a romance. It's all of these things at once. And honestly, the romance was the storyline I think I was most invested in, though I enjoyed all of it. I thought they have some lovely moments together, bonding over the piano that he kind of disassembles, and he's really struggling with this idea that he is or was a virtuoso musician himself. And you get the idea that this hearing condition that he's got has come on slightly later. Like, it's not something he was necessarily born with, and he can no longer play the piano. And it's taken a lot of immersion therapy for him to even be in the same room as a piano, because the sound causes him actual physical pain. And so him trying to overcome that disability to bond with her is actually really super sweet. And it almost feels like a film of two halves, like there's two separate tonal narratives going on at the same time. And it shouldn't work, but it kind of does. I think actually it's really because Daniel Rowe obviously directed and co-wrote this with Robert Ramsey. But I think the emotional heart of this is kind of what carries it. Partly his relationship with Harry, which is lovely. Mm. But the relationship he has with Ruthie, you're so invested in that. And even the thriller aspects of it maybe don't play out the kind of way you might expect they would in a very by-the-numbers thriller. So I think the blending of genre here is its strength, because it's not what you think it will be. It doesn't resolve in the way you think it will. And it's really sweet. And I watched this very late last night. I finished it at about 1 o'clock in the morning. And I had a great old time with it. I really, really enjoyed it. So Leo Woodall, yes.
Yeah.
Perfect pitch indeed.
He's terrific in this.
Mm. He's really, really good. I feel like if you've just seen him in something like Bridget Jones.
Or One Day.
Mm. I mean, this I think is the best calling card yet for Leo Woodall, movie star.
Yeah.
Like, this feels like it's a movie star.
And he plays kind of haunted, slightly damaged, vulnerable extremely
yeah,
well.
Yeah, he's not saying a huge amount in most scenes in this movie. He doesn't talk much, but you still know how he's feeling and what he's thinking at all times, which I think is great. It feels quite an old-fashioned movie to me as well.
It does.
It's set in New York, and it feels very New York-y. They shot in Toronto, but they've gone for a sort of, you know, that autumnal kind of New York feel to it. And it's just color-wise and just sort of, it's got the warmth of that and sort of, you know, the sense of like small, sometimes slightly run-down apartments that Harry and Ruthie are living in, but then you've got the contrast of these incredibly rich people's houses that they go to either rob them or tune grand pianos. And so there's a kind of like, you know, there's an element of social awareness, I guess, which I like. But it gives it a bit more texture, and it gives it a bit more sense of a place than I think you would get in many films that were just a thriller.
Mm-hmm.
The thriller version of this, I think, would have been much flatter, and this was much more and this was much more interesting, I think, because it does mix things up. It doesn't do exactly what you think it's going to do. You're kind of bracing for certain outcomes that don't appear, and others that do. But I think it was a really nicely played movie.
Yeah. 4 stars in for Tuner. Next up, we're going to stick with music and the new movie from John Carney. Helen, it's Power Ballad.
It's set
in Ireland, but that is not why we're asking you to review it. We're asking you to review it because we respect you as a person. Also, you're Scottish.
Apparently, yeah. This is John Carney making another movie about music. Who would have thought?
Carney's made his movie again, but when they're all this fun.
When they're all this fun, who cares? This is a really, really nice one. So you've got Paul Rudd, who honestly I think is an odd choice for a Carney hero, if I'm honest. I had to trip over that a little bit when this started, but I got into it.
What is that?
His name is literally Rick Power, which I did enjoy.
Okay.
So the idea is, I don't know, I just felt he doesn't have the usual energy I was expecting.
Well, you expect a kind of he has a slight hangdog energy, but
yeah,
he's also Paul
underdog,
Rudd.
But he is also Paul Rudd. I think that's it.
It doesn't quite gel for me.
Well, we're going to get into that.
Yeah.
He's Rick Power. The idea is he was a kind of promising young musician, fell in love with an Irish woman, married her, settled in Dublin, and is now basically the front man for a wedding band. So they're a good wedding band. We see them perform. They're perfectly competent. But, you know, the crowds are not excited when he plays his own music.
Are they called the Bride and Groove?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, love it. Yeah. But, you know, the crowds are not excited when he plays his own music. They want him to just play the hits of other people. And he is frustrated a little bit in his life, even though he loves his wife and he loves his daughter and all the rest. And he's kind of getting more and more frustrated until one night they're at a wedding, fancy big castle. And the groom is a childhood friend of an American pop star who is Danny Wilson, played by Nick Jonas. And he ends up being asked to go up on stage and sing with the wedding band. And he and Rick kind of sing together a little bit and get on well and get on talking later in the night. And then end up just shooting the shit and getting drunk and playing music together. And Rick plays something for him that he wrote. And Danny then records it as a song and claims it as his own.
Mm.
And as it becomes a huge hit, Rick is left trying and scrambling, really, to prove that this is his song and that he contributed. And, I don't want to get too much further than that, but let's say it isn't easy necessarily for him to do
Leah
that.
Leah Woodall comes in and tunes a piano.
Absolutely true.
Yeah. Cracks
a safe. It would have been great if he had, yeah. Jack Rayner actually comes in. He's the sort of manager for Danny Wilson's character. You've got Havana Roseleau again.
Yes.
As Marsha, who's Danny's love interest.
Is she also in Back Rooms? Tell me she's in Back Rooms.
I wish. She's great.
She is great. I love her. But yeah, so this is really about these two kind of lost guys who are at a tough point in their lives, because Rick is sort of, you know, he's kind of given up his dreams of stardom and everything else, meets this guy who has had the success, but he's had it as part of a boy band, and he's still very much out to prove himself as a musician. And this is, I feel like, something that the Joe Nye probably kind of know. So I, you know, I felt for both of them. Like, it's not to say that one of them isn't a fucking idiot and totally in the wrong, and that the other one isn't a force of chaos and completely incapable of organizing a paper bag. But at the same time, I felt for both of them, and I kind of wanted the best for them.
How do you organize a paper bag?
Well, you just fold it nicely, don't you?
Okay.
You don't just like scrumple it up.
Yeah, okay.
I don't know. All right, shut up. Okay. Leave me alone. Anyway, so. So I like this. I don't think it's top tier Carney. Now that is not a harsh criticism.
For people who don't know, what is top tier Carney?
Top tier Carney is the movie Once, which I think is astonishing. I think Sing Street is also astonishing.
I like Begin Again, actually.
Yeah, Begin Again is
like
very
Florence
good.
They're all good movies.
They are all good
this
movies.
This also is a good movie. I just wouldn't put it with Once and Sing Street, which for me are still like the top tier of
Carney. It does riff on Once quite nicely.
There's a lovely little reference. Yeah, that's really good. I really like that. But yeah, I had a really lovely time with it. I slightly tripped over Paul Rudd, but it wasn't his performance. It's just, I think, his Paul Ruddness.
Don't you think that works? I thought it worked.
I felt like if it had been maybe a smaller star, I felt like it would have worked better for me. In the same way that Nick Jonas brings his Nick Jonas-ness to Danny, I felt like if you had a smaller star, that would bring a smaller star, you know, energy to Rick.
I think so. I get why they cast Paul Rudd.
I get why.
Rather
it probably
been,
got this film made, and I'm glad it has been
I would
made.
Rather it had been a kind of a lesser known or even unknown actor, because I think it would have made that role work better for me. I think this is funny, because the way this is marketed is where you almost think it's going to be like an A versus B kind of like almost like caper type film where they're kind of fighting, because I mean they show like a fist fight in the trailer and whatnot, and they make it out to be something very by the numbers, and it isn't that, because, and this is the thing with all John Carney's films, like the music is always great, and the song that they argue about in this is a banging ballad.
Written by
John Carney
and Gary Clark, who was the lead singer of Danny Wilson
is the name of a band.
Correct.
Danny Wilson's the name of a band, and then they've called the character Danny Wilson.
Yes, because of Danny Wilson.
I guess so.
Okay. Yeah. Well,
otherwise,
there we
it'd be a heck of a coincidence.
We've learned something new.
Do you remember the song Mary's Prayer?
No.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Danny Wilson.
All right. All right.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
But as I was saying, the thing with John Carney's films is not only is the music at the core of the film, he has an emotional honesty to his storytelling always, and they always get you right there, and this is no exception. Like, it really, like, I felt the authenticity of that. I mean, a couple of the plot beats, especially how the whole situation resolves, I did, it has to be said, see coming a mile away. Maybe that's just me, but I thought it was just lovely, and I thought it was sort of emotionally pure, and it was really touching, and I really like the whole energy of it, which I do all his films actually. So
yeah,
I think it's well worth seeing.
Yeah, I thought it was great. I think everything's great. I've got no critical faculties whatsoever. Yeah, I really like this, and also, you know, to speak to the emotional climax of the movie, I watched this with a few Empire people a few months ago. I wrote the feature for this, and one of our number was in floods of tears at the end, and I mean floods. I mean, like, are you okay? Kind of. Floods of tears. I won't name them, yeah. Alex. No, it wasn't Alex, but it would be amusing if it was.
Yeah.
But yeah, this really does have the ability to get people. I really like John Carney. I really like his take on musical dramas. The song is an absolute belter. I think it should be nominated for Best Original Song next year, but that is a category the Oscars fuck up more than anything else, so it probably won't be. If I were to nitpick anything, it's some of the sound mixing in the live performance scenes.
Oh, with the lip syncing.
Yeah, there's some pretty bad lip syncing, and I'm not entirely sure why they didn't just sing live.
No, not just the lip syncing, but also the sound is very studio sound.
Yes.
Like, it doesn't feel in any way like a live performance.
They're playing live at home. Yeah,
I had exactly the same.
Weird and unusual. Yeah. But once you get past that, and then once Helen gets past Paul Rudd,
oh my goodness,
the last 20 minutes is fantastic. But we get this one 4 stars, and I think rightly so.
Agreed.
4 stars then for Power Ballad. Next up, Ben, this might be the big box office winner of the week, so naturally we've left it until last, is Backrooms, which is a debut by Kane Parsons, who is 12 years old.
Not far off. This is the moment where we are obliged to mention that Kane Parsons is 20, maybe 21 at this point. It is unconfirmed. But he has directed Backrooms, and this originates as like an online creepypasta. Does creepypasta mean things to people?
It means nothing to me.
Horror meme.
We have a director now called Curry Barker, and now we have creepypasta.
Creepypasta.
Yeah.
A very stupid phrase for like online horror mythology.
Yeah. Kind of urban legend-y stuff.
Comes from like copy and paste is where the term comes from.
It does. And so the idea of the Backrooms originates as like an online meme, specifically of an image of just a dank yellow hallway with a yellow carpet. And the creepiness of like, ooh, these weird liminal spaces that people talk about, where these spaces that exist and you don't really know what they're for and they feel unsettling. And that spun into Kane Parsons making a web series of Backrooms videos, found footage style, created using Blender, the same technology that they use to make Flow, the animated cat movie. So this originates as a very like grassroots internet thing. Now Kane Parsons has made a fully fledged feature for A24, starring Chiwetel Ejiofor as Clark, who runs and owns a dilapidated furniture store that is well past its prime. He is dealing with various things in his own life that have fallen apart. And so he is speaking to a therapist, Dr. Mary Klein, played by Renata Rensver. And while he is working at the store, there are weird power fluctuations, and he discovers in the basement of the store a portal, an invisible portal in the wall that takes him into a realm of yellow, sickly colored hallways and rooms that lead to other rooms that lead to other rooms that make no sense, with chairs like clipping out of the walls. Nothing makes sense. There are weird noises coming from through the back rooms. He gets obsessed with this place, with this realm that he's found, and tells his therapist about it. And then she goes in there looking for him. So that's the kind of setup. And I'm intrigued by this film. It has been very well received by many people, and I was really looking forward to it. I saw it a couple of weeks ago, and I have to say I was very disappointed in it, which feels sad. I was really looking forward
unusual
to this
film. Unusual for you, I would say.
Also, yeah, here we go. For people who say I just blindly like everything, that is absolutely not true. So I guess to start with the positives, the production design on this is incredible. Like I said, the shorts were made using Blender, but for this, they created massive physical sets.
30,000 square feet.
Of the back rooms that people could wander through, and apparently crew members were getting lost in.
James was there for several months.
That's right, I've only just got out.
Getting people tea, coffee, all sorts.
He was taking pictures of the set, but it was all just a yellow carpet.
Yeah, so weird.
I mean, so much of the success of this hinges on, can you create the back rooms and make it feel creepy? And I think it does feel atmospheric. I feel like they've done a really good job of bringing what essentially began as a still image online and turned that into an entire world that feels real and feels unsettling. I think for me, I really did not gel with the character drama here. I think to its credit, it is trying to create a compelling and psychological dynamic between Clark and Mary, getting into his real big personal character flaws, maybe that how that is represented or reflected back at him by his experiences in the back rooms, and Mary's childhood and what she is bringing with her as psychological baggage and her relationship with Clark. But I struggle a bit whenever films try and do like therapy speak and therapy, I don't know, grown-up emotionally complex therapy related dynamics. I think it's really, really hard to pull off. And I was not convinced by any of it in this film, I have to say. It's written by Will Sudik, who I'm not aware of any of his work, but I found the writing of this and the characters of this disappointingly quite thin. And I found the atmosphere in the back rooms generally unsettling, but I didn't really find this film scary, and I'm intrigued to know what Helen thinks, because I know you I was going to say a lower scare threshold than me, but I, despite finding those sequences atmospheric, you are there to watch them wander around in the back rooms, and some of those sequences, I honestly, I felt my brain just drifting off for a while.
Oh, I was proper scared.
Okay.
I was sitting next to you. Yeah.
I was very scared for pretty much most of the running time. I mean, there were times when I could tell myself, okay, it's going to be scary right now because this is the opening scare to get us unnerved. This is the guy getting shredded at the beginning of Cube, so I'm worried for the whole rest of the film, right? And there is a cubiness sometimes about this. So I kind of was bracing for the sort of little prologue bit. I was braced for that. And then I was like, okay, he probably won't die for a bit. I can probably relax a bit. But still, I you see a little bit more than I was expecting to quite early on. You see some really sinister shit. And I, I was tense throughout. I don't think it's as rich a text personally as Obsession. I still think Obsession is the high point of recent horror. I think it's fucking incredible. But this might well stay with us and sort of haunt us a little bit, because I think it does have it does have substance to it. It's not just because it's yellow like the substance, but it's just like it's got real meat on its bones, I think.
I wish that meat was tastier. I find it slightly baffling. To me, I find it baffling that this film focused on two middle-aged protagonists. I think it's a weird decision, and I feel like the film can't convincingly inhabit real grown-up problems and convey them convincingly to ground all of the other stuff that's happening here. And I have to say, I did not love the third act. Once it started to really show its hand of like, this is what we're going to do, the air was gone from the balloon, and I felt it went out with a whimper. But loads of people are loving this.
Mm. Yeah, it surprised me. I think the character work is definitely the weakest component of this, because I think they give them, shall we say, complex backstories, but I don't think it ever fully integrates into the storyline. It's never really particularly compelling. And even when it's relevant to the mythology to a certain extent, it didn't quite fit for me. This film really honestly felt like 100 minutes sort of stuck in a branch of MFI After Hours. Like, it really did. Like, I was quite palpably bored, and I wasn't scared at any point. genuinely, like, I found it quite soporific. The only thing it got me is it has that kind of slightly off-kilter Lynchian vibe, that the whole setting, the whole bat room setting, gives you that kind of almost like low-level psychic nausea, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah.
You just feel a little bit icky all the way through it.
That is the feeling of the back rooms.
Yes.
Yes, there is creepy stuff happening in there, but the real creep factor is in just the horrible, sickly mundanity of
it. Why are you in there? Go away from there.
Why does this exist? And again, the film, I think, portrays that convincingly. If you are going to see a full realization of the back rooms, you are going to get this from the film. But everything else about it, I'm disappointed. And I have to say, I sat next to Harry Stainer, our social media editor, who also was really excited for this. And we were both quite sad at the end of it because we really wanted to enjoy it.
Yeah.
He asked me to mention on the podcast that he was sad when it ended.
Yeah. Like, it's fine. It's not like it's a bad film. It's just, it looked great. And I just thought it was a bit mid.
I think
and also
was,
a bit long.
I think it was pretty good. We give it 3, which is a recommendation. Just reminding you. You know.
Yeah, it is probably a 3, but I'll never watch it again.
I don't know that, but then I don't watch a lot of these horrors again because I'm, again, a wimp.
A wimp.
So,
yeah. I haven't seen it yet. 3 stars then for Back Rooms. And real quick, how's Bells?
There is a directorial debut this week from the aforementioned, in fact, Kristen Scott Thomas, who co-wrote with her husband and directed this story, My Mother's Wedding. So she plays the mother, Diana, who is getting married for the 3rd time. Now, part of this is based on Scott Thomas's own life. So she lost both her father and her stepfather by the time she was, I think, 12, both of whom were pilots and both of whom died in plane crashes.
Whoa.
And it's only in sort of more recent years that she's talked to her younger brothers and sisters and realized that they all have very different memories of, first of all, both figures and also just, you know, what do they remember of each tragedy? So that's kind of the setup for this film. So she's simplified the family a little bit down to 3 daughters. You've got the eldest, which is Scarlett Johansson's Navy captain, Catherine. You've got Sienna Miller as a movie star, Victoria, and then Emily Beecham as a sort of, you know, NHS nurse, Georgie. And they all come back together for the wedding and, you know, family secrets come out and they're all sort of dealing with these memories in different ways and sort of reckoning with their mum getting married again and what that sort of dredges up from their past. So it is a drama. It's also very funny at times, quite warm, a lot kind of cozier than I was maybe expecting from Kristen Scott Thomas, because as aforementioned, she can be a little bit scary on screen. But this is a really warm, nice film. It mostly takes place at the family cottage, you know, and it was just sweet. I don't think it maybe gets, you know, deep enough into the different ways that all of their lives have gone and how that's affected their own experience of motherhood and that kind of thing to really make this, extraordinary exploration of, you know, grief and moving on and tragedy and all the rest. But at the same time, I do think it's a really beautifully played, really well acted, well cast, nicely put together film. So it's a good start, I think, from Kristen Scott Thomas.
All right. Did they go into scary back rooms at any point?
They don't. No, very, very no scary rooms at all. No. I mean, there's one person goes into the wrong bedroom at one point and
Oh my God.
So they get a scare, if you will. But that's about all. I give it 3 stars anyway.
Three stars. Yeah, Helen has given us 3 stars.
Recommendation.
Then. 3 stars in for My Mother's Wedding. How exciting. On that note, that is definitely it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun when we'll be joined by... not sure yet, but it'll either be Nicholas Galitzin and Camila Mendes, the stars of Masters of the Universe. I'll get you, He-Man! Or Brett Goldstein, writer and star of Office Romance. I'll get you, J-Lo! There's a lot more shagging in one of those movies than the other
one. I was surprised by that in Masters of the Universe. I got to be honest with you.
So that's why they call him Ram Man.
Ram Man, wow. Right? Wait till you hear about Fisto.
But anyway, until then, until we meet again, until that auspicious occasion, it is goodbye of my 3 colleagues of such lethal cunning. Goodbye, Ben Travis.
Goodbye. Oh no, I'm lost in the back rooms.
He's lost in the back rooms. Goodbye, James Dyer.
Goodbye, Chris.
Goodbye, Helen O'Hara.
Toodaloo.
Toodaloo to you. And it is goodbye for me. I am off to actually host an Empire VIP Club screening of Masters of the Universe. And I need to change my top because I spilt my lunch down the one I'm wearing now. and I had to go out to TK Maxx and buy a new one for £25. True story, folks. True story. Hopefully I can get this one off over the Skeletor mask that I still haven't taken off. Thanks so much for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.